This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices, united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
Good times, bad hangovers, and a lot of coffee. Hello again, it's Dustin McComas of OrangeBloods.com, and you're listening to episode 21 of the Dustin McComas Show on TheYak.com, and it's been a minute since I've knocked one of these out. I think that it was right as Texas was kind of going into its tailspin of a football season that I had baseball coming on and basketball was getting going, and just it was easy to lose track of talking about the Texas football team because, quite frankly, it wasn't very fun. It wasn't very fun to talk about Texas football as it finished the season, especially if you are as immersed in the online community that is OrangeBloods.com during a bad season, which is kind of the norm for me in my professional career. Haven't been many good ones to write and talk about and interact with on a message board with fans about as well. So apologies, but not really a sincere apology, because there's probably only so much negativity you can take, because chances are if you're listening to this podcast, you're probably listening to other podcasts or reading OrangeBloods.com or reading Twitter or reading another Texas outlet on the internet or something like that. And at some point, it's just information overkill. You know, enough is enough at some point. And people want to have at least a little bit of sunshine through all the clouds. So this is we've entered a rare quiet period for really for everything in Texas athletics right now. You know, the basketball team, I was up in Fort Worth on Sunday covering that game when Texas played Texas A&M and beat the Aggies 60-50. And Texas only has three games over, I believe, the next 22 days. That was as of Sunday after that Texas A&M game. So basically just three games over the next 3 weeks. So as they finish up classes and get into their finals and that sort of thing, the schedule really dies down for them. Obviously, baseball is smack dab in the middle of its offseason. Football is waiting for the Alamo Bowl, but there's some recruiting going on. But even that's not like extremely hot and heavy. I think Texas is basically really just trying to touch base with those current commitments, keep those guys locked in. Before the Alamo Bowl and what could be more staff changes on the horizon. And, you know, as we kind of had the Bloody Sunday, to borrow a musical lyric, when Tom Herman announced a couple of staff moves and the firing of Drew Maringer and defensive coordinator Todd Orlando. But I don't know if that's the last coaching changes we'll have of the guys that are currently on staff. I think there's probably a few that don't know for certain if they'll be back at Texas. Some of that probably depends on who's hired at offensive coordinator, who's hired at defensive coordinator, what kind of guys those people want to bring in. And if you've paid attention to Tom Herman recently and read our content at OrangeBloods.com, you know, development is a big, big piece of the puzzle for Tom Herman and something that he's really, really focusing on when he makes these coordinator hires, because it just hasn't been up to where it needs to be at Texas. And we'll get into an example of that later on when discussing the Big 12 and as it relates to Texas. But, you know, the developmental piece is such a big focus of Tom Herman. It's not just the scheme. It's not, you know, recruiting, not just recruiting or things like that. They got to start developing guys. They got to start taking some of these highly rated recruits and turning them into all conference players. You know, I saw Jim Vertuno, who works in the Austin market and covers the team, among other things, for the Associated Press. You know, he tweeted out, I think it was like last week, that if you combine like the honorable mention teams and all the Big 12 teams, Kansas had 10 players on those lists and Texas only had 9. That's, I mean, if that's not a sign that changes needed to happen, I'm not sure what is, because there should be no situation ever when Texas has fewer players on those lists than Kansas. And it's not like this is, you know, Mark Mangino's Kansas team that's winning a bunch of football games with Todd Reesing. This Kansas team was terrible. I think if you go look at the advanced metrics, they were probably, in terms of overall rankings, right around 100. So even though I think Les Miles is starting to, I don't know if turn the corner is the right phrase, but they're starting to show some signs of not being one of the worst teams in college football every single season, but they still weren't good. So it's not like this was a rare good Kansas football team. No, it wasn't a good Kansas team. And yet they had more players on the All Big 12 list than Texas did, which gets back to this developmental piece. So we are in, at least right now, I say this knowing that I could jinx it and all of a sudden things can really, really pick up right away. But it does seem like we are in a rare quiet period right now, especially for a program that still has to hire a defensive coordinator and an offensive coordinator. And if you follow the reporting on orangebloods.com, most notably from Anwar Richardson, Tom Herman has, he's interviewed Chris Ash on campus. He's met with, USC offensive coordinator Graham Harrell, but there haven't been any actual offers extended to any coordinators for the open vacancy. So it sounds like Herman is definitely doing his due diligence. He really, really wants to get this thing right. He wants to try to, as much as he can while in the hiring process, develop some sort of relationship with these candidates, especially somebody that he eventually would offer the job to. So while you're seeing, Florida State hired Mike Norvell and he just hired the Auburn offensive coordinator that he goes way, way back with, and Auburn immediately responded by hiring Chad Morris, who, of course, was a free agent after being fired in Arkansas. So you are seeing some programs move pretty quickly in this situation. And, there is this early signing period looming. But I think, at least from what we know right now and the way things have played out so far, it does seem like Tom Herman is really taking his time, being deliberate, being meticulous to make sure he gets this thing right, and going and trying to get the best of the best in terms of the coordinators. And I think that it's, I know fans, they want it to happen now. It's Christmas time, the holiday season is here, and I feel like Texas fans are, some of them are acting like children, like, I want my presents now. I want Santa to come tomorrow. I want to unwrap my gifts. I want to celebrate Christmas today, not 2 weeks from now. And, Tom Herman has got to get this right. He has to get these hires right. You don't often see a situation where a head coach at a program like Texas basically has to hire two coordinators, not because those guys left for other jobs, but because he either demoted or fired those coaches. You don't often see it happen, and if it does happen, it just doesn't suggest success in the future. I'm a big believer in the third year for a head coach at a program like Texas being the year where you really get the true indication of where things are going. It's based on a lot of studying. It's based on a lot of data. It's based on past history. And I think past history is our best indicator of what can happen in the future. Now, not all situations are created equally and this and that. And I know Tom Herman inherited a mess. He's not the only guy that inherited a mess at places. Look at what Pete Carroll inherited at USC. Look at what Nick Saban inherited at, Alabama. And I know Nick Saban's kind of in his own league when that comes to that sort of thing. But Tom Herman's not the only guy to walk into a mess. If you have a couple of really good recruiting classes and you can coach, you can get back at a place like Texas. Just look at the second season with the Sugar Bowl. And that's, everything was on the path to suggesting that this thing was really going to work at a very high level at Texas for Tom Herman. The first season, the regular season didn't end like they thought, but they won a bowl game. They showed a little bit of a sign of growth. Follow that up with a good recruiting class. Get into the second season, didn't start the way they wanted to, played better football as the season progressed, got better, got into the Big 12 championship game, got to the Sugar Bowl, won the Sugar Bowl, won 10 wins for the first time in a long time, showed real signs of growth. So you could see, it's not always linear, and that's something Shaka Smart says a lot. I feel like I've almost had that ingrained in my brain. I've heard him say it so much about player growth and team growth and things like that. But it's true. In college athletics, growth is not linear. There are going to be ups. There's going to be downs. But overall, if you plot it all out on a graph, you want to see that arrow trending in the right direction of improvement. And after the first two seasons at Texas, it was for Tom Herman. He had another good recruiting class on top of it. The quarterback was a candidate to be, you know, a Heisman Trophy winner. The schedule set up pretty well in the Big 12. You know, not playing LSU obviously isn't easy, and LSU proved to perhaps have the best LSU team ever. So that wasn't easy, but from the Big 12 standpoint, the schedule set up well. The league was there for the taking, as shown by Baylor playing for the Big 12 championship under Matt Rhule, who built his own program from the ashes, basically, and he inherited a much worse situation than Tom Herman did. So you want to see that growth just kind of going in the right direction. And when you get to year three and it doesn't, that's a big red flag. You just don't see many instances where that season things go south and the head coach is able to rebound and elevate that program back to speaking from the Mac Brown years, but elevate that program to an elite tier where it's winning and competing for conference championships and competing for playoff appearances and that sort of thing. So Tom Herman has got to get this right. You know, at Texas, you really only get one opportunity to do what he's doing, which is basically hire almost an entire new coaching staff. He's hiring two new coordinators, basically. You don't get more than one chance to do that at Texas. Unless you're like Mac Brown and you've got the thing rolling and guys are leaving for head coaching opportunities or something like that. This is not it. This is Tom Herman understanding that he has to make a change. And look, he had to make a change. We'll talk about the defensive side of the ball here in a little bit about why, you know, some of the reasons why, even just as I'm watching football last weekend, I'm just reminded of he had to make a change on defense. But he had to make a change. He understood that he needed to make a change in order to get this program or try to elevate this program. And I'm sure that wasn't easy for him. He's a guy that's never had to fire anybody before as a head coach. Kind of foreign territory for him. I imagine that he agonized over that some. But that's, you know, that's why you paid the big bucks. That's why you wanted the opportunity at the University of Texas is while the, you know, when it's going great, it's really going great and the money's great. But when it's going bad, it's a lot to handle. You know, it's not an easy gig when things are going poorly. So I don't fault Tom Herman for taking his time with this process, assuming, of course, they can keep this recruiting class locked in. You don't want a situation where you start seeing recruits jump off the ship, you know, a decommitment here, a decommitment there, and all of a sudden over the next couple of weeks you're up to like five or six decommitments. That would be an issue. Because you can probably say that that's related to, hey, I want to know who my coaches are type situation. So, but that's just not happening for Texas right now. And I'm not sure, I mean, I would bet right now that it's not going to happen. I think they're going to keep a vast majority of those guys locked into the equation. So I don't fault Tom Herman for being deliberate with this. I don't fault him for not wanting to rush into this decision because I think he's aware that he's got to get it right. He can't run the risk of just making a hire to make a hire and it not work out. Because if it doesn't work out, he's not going to work out at Texas. And say what you want about him and if he rubs people the wrong way and this and that, but this is a dream job to Tom Herman. He's dreamed about being the head coach at the University of Texas. And now he is, and he's got to make sure he gets it right. So I don't fault him for wanting to take his time with that. As long as taking his time isn't turning into all of the top candidates being off the board and you're kind of searching for option 7, 8, or 9 as opposed to option 1, 2, or 3, that's when you run into a little bit of a situation there and when things can get really, really risky. But we're not seeing, you know, I saw the Utah defense coordinator Scaley re-signed a deal there. But that, I mean, he wasn't really a name that was, I guess, strongly linked to Texas. There's some scuttlebutt about it, but not one of those guys that, you know, I know at orangewoods.com we were reporting a lot about Ash. Did I say David Ash earlier in the podcast? I hope I did. Chris Ash, former Rutgers head coach and defensive coordinator at Ohio State when Herman was there. And then Graham Harrell, Joe Brady, they're two names that we've reported at orangewoods.com. So he's keeping, not only is Tom Herman taking his time, he's doing a good job of keeping a lot of these names under wraps, and I think that that's intentional. So as long as the guys at the top of his list don't start flying off the board and either staying put or, you know, I saw like Graham Harrell reportedly got offered a raise and an extension, which hasn't really been any conversation about that since then, so perhaps that's good news for Texas if it moves in that direction. But as long as Herman's top candidates aren't flying off the board, I think he can afford to be deliberate with this, and I don't think it's a bad thing. I know Texas fans want it now, 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 and they want all the answers now. And I see people at OrangeWhites.com, and they, oh, the mods are not telling us stuff. No, like sometimes these things just take a little while. They're going to move at the speed the head coach wants them to move, and it seems like, from what we know now, that Tom Herman wants to be deliberate with this. You know, I'm not saying that it's going to take a month or weeks or whatever, but I would be surprised if it happened tomorrow, which, you know, now that I say that, I'm opening myself up to it happening tomorrow, but I would be really, really surprised if that were the case. So while Tom Herman is doing his holiday shopping, you've got some quiet time to do your holiday shopping and, you know, not having to constantly hit refresh on the message board, although we always do encourage you to stay on OrangeWhites.com and hit refresh often and be a part of our unmatched community. I mentioned early on about the defensive coordinator in it being obvious that Texas needed to make a change there, and I was watching the Big 12 championship game between Baylor and Oklahoma, and I'm watching Baylor's defensive line and, you know, the three-man front that they often use. And I'm watching those defensive ends, Lockhart and Lynch. Lockhart, I believe, was pretty heavily recruited by Texas. And I'm watching those guys make Jalen Hurts really uncomfortable. Really uncomfortable. They're pressuring him. They're making him uncomfortable. He was always kind of looking for where they were. He wasn't really able to hang in the pocket. But he really wasn't able to escape all the time either. And this is a Heisman Trophy finalist, a guy that's played a ton of football at the highest level. And I'm sitting there watching Baylor's defensive line do this with three guys, and I'm thinking, why couldn't Texas do this? You know, we saw Iowa State do it to Texas. We saw Baylor do it to Texas. We've seen other teams in college football and even the Big 12 have success getting after the quarterback with these three-man fronts. And I'm thinking to myself, as I'm watching this game, like, Texas fans got to be, you know, reaching for the beer fridge or pouring another bourbon or something. Like, why couldn't our football team do this? Because it's not like Baylor has more talent than Texas. I think that they've done a better job over the past couple of years of developing that talent on the defensive line especially, and maybe even the whole defensive side of the football. Although there's been some, you know, Charles and Minnehue and some other guys that had really nice seasons at Texas before moving on to professional football. But I'm thinking, okay, why? Like, what's the disconnect between what's happening at Texas or what happened at Texas this season and what's happening at these other places when they're at least from a personnel standpoint, doing some similar things and having way more success with it? And I think back to, you know, what Marquez Bimage did against Texas Tech. Now, I know Texas Tech's not very good, but Texas Tech wasn't Kansas or West Virginia this year either. It wasn't a terrible football team. In fact, the only team that beat Texas Tech by more than Texas did was Oklahoma, and I'm pretty confident that Texas Tech didn't lose another. They only lost two Big 12 games all year by more than 10 points, Texas and Oklahoma. So for the most part, they played everybody very, very competitively. Think back to that Baylor game in Waco. They should have won that game. They're screwed by the officials. So this wasn't a horrible football team. And I'm seeing Marquez Bimage come in there, and he's just wrecking shop. He's just getting up field. He's using his athleticism. He's going after the football. He's trying to go after the quarterback. He's making some things happen. Taquan Graham had some moments where he flew into the backfield as well. Malcolm Roach. And it's just like, what was different about this game than all of the other games? And then I'm watching the Big 12 championship game, and I'm like, what is Baylor doing that Texas isn't? And I think it just gets back to the way either it was scheme, either it was technique or instruction or whatever. But the way Texas had its defensive ends playing, I just don't think it allowed those guys to have the type of success that those other defensive lines were having, like Iowa State and Baylor using three-man front and getting pressure on the quarterback and those types of things. But clearly, Texas has the talent. And bring a guy like Bimage, which why he didn't play more, I have no idea. That's a really athletic, explosive, strong football player. He's got some juice, man. He really bounces out of his stance. He can use his hands. He's got a good motor. That's the kind of guy that should be getting pressure on the quarterback on a semi-consistent or better basis. You know, a guy that reportedly squats over 700 pounds. And it's just, you know, why? Why did it take Todd Orlando and his staff until basically the very last game of the season, or maybe not even that game. I mean, maybe those guys just played really well despite it. I'd have to go back and look. But why couldn't Texas do what some of these other teams in the Big 12 did? And I think it was just another example of Texas had to make a change at defense. There was far too much of a very, very, very late reactive nature to the Texas defense instead of being proactive and instead of quickly adjusting. Think back to all the delayed blitzing. I mean, even the Texas Tech game, Texas was still doing some of the same things. These delayed blitzes where you're sending these guys on, you know, this curved route from 5 or 7 yards away from the snap of the football. And, you know, it takes them 3 or 4 seconds to get in there and the ball's already out. And it's probably down the field attacking a one-on-one coverage. Or even when you're dropping 8, there's still, for some inexplicable reason, a safety and one-on-one coverage way down the field, despite you having 8 guys in coverage. Or maybe you're dropping coverage another time and you've got your linebackers spying or in like a green light type situation where if they read a running back blocking, they go after the quarterback after the ball snap and they're vacating the middle of the field and it's just open. Like, those sorts of things just kept happening over and over again. And Todd Orlando did adjust in some situations. They did get away at least in frequency from some things that were giving them issues. But overall, the overall big package of the defense just was begging for change. And maybe the defensive line, especially the lack of pressure situations from the defensive ends, maybe that was where it was most apparent, although I'd argue that the style of blitzing and the way they were covering when they dropped 8 was probably the biggest thing that signaled, hey, we got to have a change here. And, you know, sometimes I'm a big statistics guy. I really like looking at the advanced statistics. I think we can learn a lot from those things, whether it's S&P Plus, FEI, FEI defense, FEI offense, special teams ratings, S&P plus offense and defense, and all these sorts of things. I think it gives us a good idea of what kind of football team the team you cover or watch is. You know, before the season began, I think S&P plus projected Texas to be the number 31 team in the country. And Texas fans at the beginning of the season were kind of losing their mind about that. Before the Texas Tech game, Texas was number 31 in S&P plus. Now, after Texas Tech, I think they moved up to 29 because of how well they played. But these things are often painting a pretty accurate picture of what's going on. So I noticed throughout the season that FEI had added a stat. I think they added it this year called busted drive rate. They have it for both offense and defense. And we're going to focus on the defensive side of it because that's what we're talking about, the defensive side of the football. And Todd Orlando needed to make a change there. But busted drive rate, as defined by footballoutsiders.com, is the percentage of opponent offensive drives that earn 0 or negative yards. So how often is your defense creating drives against the opposing offense that either result in 0 or negative yards? Maybe they throw the ball 3 straight times and they're all incompletions. Or maybe you get, you know, a tackle for loss and a sack or something like that, and they don't gain the yardage to make it, you know, 4th and 10 or less or something like that. So basically, how often is your defense forcing an offense into a drive that goes nowhere or goes in reverse? And there are 130 Division I football teams. So there are 130 teams in the rankings. Texas finished dead last in busted drive rate. Dead last. 130th in busted drive rate. And what that tells me is, too often, or basically every game that Texas played, the opposing coaching staff was very comfortable with what Texas was going to do and what Texas was showing during the game. They were very comfortable with what they saw in film, how to build a game plan, and what they saw during the game. Because there weren't many times where an opposing offense just looked totally overwhelmed or surprised or just completely out of rhythm. Texas had some better defensive games down the stretch. You know, that they kept their team in the game at Baylor. They didn't play poorly against Oklahoma in the Cotton Bowl. They had some bright moments on occasion against TCU. But to finish 130th in anything at Texas is not good. But to finish 130th in busted drive rate tells me a lot of what our eyes were telling us during the season is that this Texas defense wasn't properly built for this Big 12 against these coaches. It wasn't throwing any of these coaches curveballs. It was doing a lot of the same things. It was tipping what it was doing during the game, and it was being attacked the same way over and over and over again. And it wasn't adjusting. It wasn't doing things dramatically differently. And I think that showed up the most on third downs. You know, how many times did Texas have a third and long passing situation and we know they're going to blitz and they come after somebody and it's an easy throw and catch, or it's a throw and catch into one-on-one coverage. Just a winnable type play to generate a first down. I think that sometimes we probably shouldn't ever judge a unit of football on one stat to tell a story. But I don't know. I think in this case, we can pretty confidently say that finishing 130th, dead last in college football, and busted drive rate for a defense pretty much tells us the story of the Texas defense this year. That it wasn't confusing or bothering or disrupting opposing offenses and opposing offensive coaching staffs nearly enough. The teams that played Texas each week knew what they were going to see from the Texas defense and were able to quickly adjust to what Texas was doing during the games. I mean, think about that. 130th. That means you're not sacking the quarterback. That means you're not creating a lot of negative plays in the run game. That means you're not getting off the field on third down. And these are all things that we saw. We saw Texas just not get to the quarterback. We saw Texas routinely give up third down long completions and passing down situations. I think Texas did a pretty decent job at times of run stuffing and run blitzing and run down situations. But the problem is when they got to passing down situations on third down, they couldn't get off the field. So, just going back to the way, you watching Baylor get pressure on Jalen Hurts with a three-man front, and then watching the Texas defensive line all year, and then watching other teams in the Big 12 have success using a similar personnel usage on defense, and then you look at the busted drive rate, I'm not sure how you can make a real argument that Texas didn't need to make a change of defensive coordinator. And, I'm not trying to pile on to Todd Orlando. I'm sure he's doing just fine. He's going to land on his feet somewhere. He didn't get to Texas by not being good at his job. It just didn't work for him at Texas this season. And I think that's a lot to do with their lack of adapting, their lack of creating a defense that confused the opposition, that got off the field on third downs, that created negative plays and those sorts of things. I mean, just watching that Big 12 championship game, I had images in my head of Texas fans watching that Baylor defensive line do what it did to Jalen Hurts and thinking, why couldn't we do that? It's Baylor getting after it. No, Lynch is a hell of a player. And Lockhart is a good player too. But Texas has plenty of those guys on the roster that could be those types of players as well. We can't end this podcast on a low note, revisiting the issues of the Texas defense this year. So let's end it on a high note. It is the holiday season. It is, hopefully for you, work's kind of slowing down a little bit. You're able to relax some. You're able to knock out all of your Christmas shopping and those sorts of things. And, get some time putting the tree up, putting the lights up. If you've got kids, taking the kids to look at the lights around the city and that sort of thing. And sit in front of the TV and enjoy a lot of the, good Christmas movies. So I've got a list of mine that every year I watch these movies at least once. I'm not saying they're the absolute best, because there are some really good ones that I don't even have on this list, because they're just, in terms of rewatchable status for me, they don't trump some of these other ones, even though they could, from a critical standpoint, be better movies. But these are the ones that every year I watch and I enjoy, and they never ever get old. And you have to start with Christmas Vacation. I mean, how many times do you walk around and say the shitter's full? I even have that little moose mug that I drink eggnog out of during the Christmas time. It never gets old. it's funny. It's got kind of the Christmassy feel-good story to it at the end. It's got the message about, you know, the importance of family and all those sorts of things. It's got great characters. It's got good acting. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous in some ways, but it's just really entertaining. I mean, I don't understand how Clark Griswold could ever get old. I actually have a Clark Griswold jersey in my closet. Yeah, a t-shirt jersey. You know how he wears his Blackhawks jersey around the house during one of those scenes? So I've got a Blackhawks jersey that says Griswold on the back of it, which comes in handy whenever I do go to some Christmas parties. So Christmas Vacation tops my list. Number one movie for me to rewatch during the holidays. Number two, a strong number two. This could easily be number one. Love Actually. And, I've kind of been surprised. I was reading up on the internet about Love Actually and just the... sorry about knocked over a reindeer on the table there. I was reading the reaction of just like where Love Actually ranks on like the Christmas movie list. And I'm surprised that it's pretty... You're either really, really, really about Love Actually or you don't like it at all. There's not really a middle ground, which kind of surprised me. I think it's one of those ones you could find on TV and just, you know, do something else in the background while it's on and still kind of enjoy watching it. But yeah, it's cheesy in parts. It's ridiculous in parts. You know, the guy going from the UK to Wisconsin and he finds, you know, the girl from American Pie who's got the worst Texas accent or Southern accent or whatever accent that would require a cowboy hat ever. Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some ridiculous moments, but it's got a really strong cast. It's got some like great moments, you know, Hugh Grant dancing in the, whatever they call where the prime minister lives, when that song comes out and he's kind of dancing down the stairwell and that sort of thing. That's a great moment. You know, his eventual girlfriend, when she cusses, it's just a really good moment. You've got Sam, you know, learning how to play the drums because he's trying to win over the girl and he just lost his mom. And, you know, Liam Neeson, it's nice to see him in a character that's not trying to track down somebody with a cell phone and kill him. Like he pretty much does in all of his movies now. It's got a really strong cast. It's got humor. It's got serious moments. It's got that kind of feel good Christmas message. It's kind of got a lot of different stories going at once that all blend together. And it's got a really good soundtrack, too. I mean, every time I hear the Beach Boys, God Only Knows, come on, I immediately think of that scene in Love Actually when it plays. And just all the people in the airport hugging each other and things like that. So it's a really feel-good movie. You get some laughs at it. And it's got so much going on that I don't feel like it ever really gets old because it's kind of blending a bunch of different stories together at one time. Home Alone and Home Alone 2, like, I grew up in the era of Home Alone. Like, it was a big thing when I was around that age. You know, everybody had, like, the little tape recorder type thing that Kevin McAllister had. It's got good acting. The soundtracks are really, really good. And it's hard not to feel good at the end of both of those movies. Just even as ridiculous as it is, like, wait a minute, you lost him again? Like, you know, like how realistic is that? But just the ends of those movies, you know, the moment, you know, where Buzz is screaming in Home Alone 1, and then the moment in 2 where he, you know, McAllister's dad finds the bill to the really, I think that's the Plaza Hotel in New York City, which I actually went into the Plaza shops. When I was in New York City last month, when I was up there covering Texas basketball. Man, is that a nice place. I think they're all residencies now and not a hotel. So you can't even really get in to the part where the rooms are, but still, it's a fantastic looking building and really, really nice inside. But it's hard to, it's like impossible not to feel good after you watch that. And it's also, you don't like, you watch that movie and you want to go booby trap a bunch of stuff. It, you know, just kind of set up things around the house or like, I don't know. You just want to relive those types of moments where, you know, the little kid gets one over, on the burglars that have somehow found him again, in New York City the second time, after finding him in Home Alone 1. So those are definitely ones that I watch every Christmas time as well. A Charlie Brown Christmas, I like mixing in the lighthearted, fun, animated movies, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, Frosty the Snowman, but A Charlie Brown Christmas is definitely the top of my list for that. It's just really well done. It never gets old. It's got the holiday message and themes with it, and kind of the traditional Charlie Brown and Peanuts vibe to everything as well. It's one of those ones where it's all, if I find it on TV, I usually end up finishing it for sure because it's a really enjoyable rewatch. And this is going to cause some debate. Well, probably causes some debate every year. I feel like I mention it in my column every single year around this time. But Die Hard. Yes, Die Hard is a Christmas movie. It just so happens to be a Christmas movie that also includes a lot of killing and cops and terrorists and, you know, a big building in Los Angeles and all those sorts of things. But it is a Christmas movie. There are definite moments where it clearly shows that it is a Christmas movie. Just because it's not like, you know, A Christmas Carol or Home Alone or Miracle on 34th Street or Santa Claus or the Elf or all those sorts of things doesn't mean it's not a Christmas movie. It still has the Christmas storyline going on, all those events taking place around Christmas. So I don't know how you could debate against it. Die Hard is a Christmas movie, and so is Gremlins for that matter, which I enjoy watching as well, although it's not one that I go out of my way for this time of the year. But Die Hard, absolutely. There's going to be a point in time where Die Hard is going to be on either TBS or TNT in the next few weeks, and I'm going to watch it. Hell, I might record it because it is one of my favorite Christmas movies. You know, just John McClane's character and, you know, the weird Christmas inclusions and things like that. You know, he even has a point in the movie where he says, "I got invited to a Christmas party. Who knew?" Like it's in the movie. It's not just like a one-off situation where they're like, "Oh, late December around Christmas," and that's the only mention of it. There's multiple instances where it specifically references Christmas. So Die Hard is in fact a Christmas movie, and it finishes my list of rewatchable movies that I love watching at least once this time of year. What are your favorite ones to watch? You can, you know, tweet at me at DemonComusOB, email me Dustin@orangebloods.com. You know, you can post at me with a PM or a reply on orangebloods.com as well, with whatever your favorite rewatchable Christmas movies are this time of year. You know, I'm probably going to knock out Love Actually at least once this week, and also Christmas Vacation at least once this week as well, especially if I stock up on some Pennsylvania Dutch eggnog. And with that, let's wrap up episode 21 of the Dustin McComas Show on theyak.com. I'm Dustin McComas of orangebloods.com. Thank you for listening. Get to theyak.com. We've got a lot of podcast content every single week. We've got new episodes, whether it's recruiting, whether it's football, whether it's basketball, whether it's baseball, whether it's Austin FC, whether it's Liverpool soccer, whether it's non-sports things, whatever it is. I feel like every time I refresh theyak.com, we've got a new podcast up there. So I hope that you are enjoying the holiday season. I hope things are slowing down for you. You're able to knock out a lot of your Christmas shopping. You're able to, you know, spend some time with some friends and family. You're able to, you know, enjoy some of your favorite movies. You know, put up some lights around the house. Just kind of get into the spirit of things. It really is a truly fun, enjoyable time of the year. I feel like it's a great time for everybody to kind of recharge their batteries a little bit. And for us that cover the University of Texas, and for fans following the University of Texas, it's a rare quiet period right now until bowl game practices start going and the coordinator search really intensifies and basketball, the frequency of the basketball games picks back up and all that sort of thing. So to be honest, I am totally enjoying a slow week for a change, and I hope that you are as well. So once again, thank you for listening. Get to theyak.com. Follow me on Twitter at DemonComusOB. And until I talk to you next time, happy holidays. Take care.